good day to you wherever you may be. We're broadcasting today from the land global warming forgot. Woke up this morning and the temperatures were in the single digit. So it's a little chilly down here. We've got Kirk and Scott with us. How are you, fellas?
Well, it's cold here. It's wet.
Yeah.
I got the negatives.
Oh, okay.
Apparently there's real negatives in the world. negative numbers.
Yeah, there are negative numbers. I had heard that, speaking of where you are, Kirk, that that California just said that their policies, this is one of the things back on Shattering Mist several years ago, I was touting was going to happen. But they're going to impose their control over water use and consumer and business water use because well, they say that, you know, the drought is now in its sixth year, but wasn't it in El Nino last year, and wasn't rainfall above normal last year?
We, yes, sir, and we have so much water right now, we're bracing for floods.
Yeah, it's again above.
It's unbelievable how much water is coming down. We're blowing out water as quick as they can get it out of the dam, and we're out there.
Yeah, they're dewatering the reservoirs. Right, they're trying to dewater the reservoirs so that they don't go into flood stage. So if you've had 2 years in a row that are abnormally high in terms of rainfall, and then you can't be in your sixth year of consecutive year of drought, can you? Somebody's math is not working.
Yeah, well, you know, that's only a good one.
Yeah. So the whole purpose of the whole thing was to set up an ability to control, which is the whole purpose of the climate change argument. It has nothing to do with the Earth's climate. It has all to do with control mechanisms. In that case, I've been watching the news on something that that just absolutely baffles me. The news this morning was focused on a singular thing, which is the Russians deliberately engaged to throw the U.S. election away from Hillary Clinton and to Donald Trump because they thought that Donald Trump would somehow serve Russian interests. And I don't think there's a person in any one of the three venues, the Democrats who are promoting it along with the media, the intelligence community who have now begun to promote it, or the Trump campaign, I don't know if you call it a campaign or administration, is between the two, who doesn't seem to have any intelligent response to it. And yet it is also enormously clear to me. And let's just begin with, if your email communication causes people to lose respect for you, is it the fault of the individual who exposes your email communications or your fault that you lose credibility?
Well, my question was, did they tell a lie or did they tell the truth? If they told the truth and repeated what you said, then the chips fall to you, not them.
Right. Is there anybody on the Democratic side, because their emails were exposed, that is saying, oh, no, the Russians changed what we wrote. That is not what we actually said. No, there's not been a single accusation of they changed what we wrote. So it is what they wrote. And if what you actually said causes people to lose respect for you, then it's not the fault of that of the individual that exposes you. It is solely and completely the fault of the person who wrote that, which was self-incriminating. Correct? Now, why can't Trump say that? Now, the next thing is that I heard today that the reason now that they're willing, the CIA, NSA, the Director of National Intelligence, the FBI, the reason that they're all in lockstep now saying that the Russians did this deliberately is because the United States intelligence community has intercepted Russian emails and telephone conversations congratulating one another on the role that they played in the election of Donald Trump. Do you think that with that reporting, there'd be somebody amongst the talking heads of the liberal media would say, uh-oh, we just exposed our problem here. If, in fact, the United States intercepted Russian emails and telephone conversations, then aren't we as guilty as they are? In fact, are we not guilty of the very thing that we're accusing them of?
Of course.
And if that, according to McCain, is an act of war, did we not commit an act of war against Russia? And, oh, by the way, haven't we been doing this now for decades?
Well, not to mention that if that's the case, if that is an act of war, isn't technically the NSA and all the stuff that they were collecting, isn't that an act of war upon the American people by our own
indeed.
Government?
According to if McCain had a brain, that would be correct. That is the only logical implication of any of this. And, you know, when you realize that Snowden exposed the fact that the United States was spying on both the emails and telecommunications of the Merkel of Germany and of the past four French presidents, as well as friends and enemies alike around the world, how in the world can anybody say that we ought to put sanctions on Russia? For example, there was a senator who said, you know, that Obama, when he found out about this, all he did was toss a pebble at the Russians. If it were up to me, we'd pick up a big damn stone and throw it at them. You know, when you live in a glass house, yeah, you don't throw stones. Do you think it's possible that that senator doesn't know that the United States is more engaged in listening to and in reading the emails of foreign governments than any other country, in fact, more than every other country on Earth combined?
We're the only ones who have that kind of capacity.
Well, they do it to us American citizens. They do it to our allies.
So why can't Trump just simply say this? Why can't he say, listen, here's the fact of the matter. If Hillary Clinton's emails and the DNC's emails embarrass them so as to cause people to shift their support, whose fault is that? And second, right, how is it that exposing the truth has ever been an issue in terms of a democracy? Now, I want to ask you one other question. Have you heard the old adage that you should never throw stones if you live in a glass house? Who do we know in the world who has done more of this than any other country in human history?
United
now,
States.
So if Trump just simply said those three things, you'd not only embarrass the media, but you'd hold everyone accountable. For example, when Trump says, you know, you can't trust the intelligence community, all he would have had to have said is, did James Clapper, who is now flapping his lips against Trump and against the Russians, did James Clapper tell the U.S. Congress the truth when he said that the United States was not engaged in the surveillance of Americans through any form of mega data seizures?
No, he totally lied.
He was under oath, and he deliberately and knowingly lied to the United States Congress.
And he's still there.
So why would you trust him now? You know, Trump brings up all the time, he says the reason you can't trust them is they were wrong about the weapons of mass destruction, and therefore look at the mess we have now in Iraq and Syria as a result of them being wrong. They're wrong on major issues. They, you know, there's an issue here. You don't need to go back that far. You know, there's a book coming out that is written by a person that just despises Snowden, and it, you know, claims to be unbiased, and it's one of the most biased pieces of trash that I've ever read. But, you know, I'm biased as it relates to Edward Snowden. I think Edward Snowden provided America one of the greatest gifts in the nation's history, as did WikiLeaks, by exposing the fact the United States was involved in breach of its own constitution and unreasonable search and seizure.
By the way, Snowden, to no benefit of himself.
Right.
He has gained nothing from it. In fact, he is exiled from his his friends, family.
Right.
So he hasn't gained anything from it.
Right. Now, this individual says the reason you should be opposed, you should praise Snowden for revealing the fact the United States government is out of whack. Then he says, but you know, intelligence is a most important part of governance, and that, you know, we need it. And he therefore did things that that somehow made our intelligence capability less robust. Well, I'd make it less robust. I would take it to zero.
Can you show me anywhere where it's done something? It's done something really positive.
No, as a matter of fact, you know, the only example they could give when Dianne Feinstein and James Clapper were trying to justify the NSA right after Snowden's release of information. This goes back years ago. The only example they gave is an individual that I spent three shows exposing his history on Shattering Myths. And that was the example of the fellow that they said they had prevented this specific guy from by a terrorist act by the NSA. As a fact, he is one of the most ruthless terrorists in the world. He's the planner of the Mumbai terrorist attacks that killed between 200 and 300 people. And both of his ex-wives testified to James Clapper when Clapper was with the FBI, telling him precisely what he was going to do. And yet, Clapper did not divulge that information. And he went ahead and perpetrated that attack, and hundreds of people died as a result. And James Clapper knew that history when he said, no, there's the person that the NSA kept from committing a terrorist attack. No. You knew that he was a drug dealer, that he was part of the Taliban. You tried to lure him with money to be a double agent. You failed. He killed hundreds of people. And you think the American people are so stupid, I mean, for the most part, he was right, that you'll be able to use that, your greatest failure, as an example of your success, and then you're going to go after the integrity of Edward Snowden, which he has? It's just utterly reprehensible. But we do have a woman in shining armor. Yes, Michelle Obama came out today and said that she hopes that the way that she acted in the White House made Americans proud.
I just heard a laughter from downstairs.
Oh my God, makes America proud. Why would we be proud of a woman who married somebody that was elected to office? What on earth? Did she do something noble and jump out in front of a runaway train to save a preschool? Did she donate her own personal money? Oh, she didn't have any. To some greater good? No. What she did is she went from never ever having worked in her life, just like her husband, to living high on the hog, now renting a extraordinarily expensive home outside in actually Washington.
Mm-hmm.
This is the woman that had the taxpayer spend tens of millions of dollars to trot she and her children around Europe and around Africa. She is the woman who decided that, you know, other first ladies have had two or three staff who have supported their charitable endeavors, and she increased that by 10 to 20 fold. And she said, I led by example. I don't know many examples like that. Do you have anybody providing you with a mega airplane to fly your family around the world and paying you for providing with huge staff and the like? Oh, how about the $50 million home that they stayed in every year over the holiday break in Hawaii?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how does one on the salary of the President of the United States pay for a stay at a $50 million home?
That's a good trick.
I can't do it. You know, I made a lot of money.
Yeah. You just bleed the public.
Oh, my God. We are really in some interesting times, aren't we?
Yeah. You know, the last thought on the thing about the exposing the, about the emails and all this.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Doesn't it tell you something too that if you doesn't it expose their ineptness to keep a secret? I mean, it,
yes.
No matter what came out, if nothing came out negative in their conversations, that should tell you don't trust these people. You can't tell them anything. They're communicated, and anybody can find out. There are times when you don't want everybody to know everything you got to say.
You know, for example, today, Trump is trying to get Congress to investigate how NBC News got the national security update on the Russian involvement in the elections 4 or 5 hours before he did. It's top secret.
Mm-hmm.
How do they get it? So somebody in the United States National Intelligence Community gave a copy of a report written for the President of the United States to NBC News. Now, would you trust such people?
No.
Of course not. Of course not.
I'd want to put them in jail. Because if you want to tread in this water, you got to play by the rules.
Yeah, I have no issues on the fact that people keep secrets. We all keep secrets.
Sure.
But, you know, if you write an email and you're not smart enough to know that the United States and other countries around the world have the capacity to read what you wrote and can use it against you, you're an idiot. I mean, if you were to say, you know, let's just say that that the three of us have this great scheme that we're going to defraud the Federal Reserve out of $1 billion. Would there be anyone of the, okay? Would any one of the three of us decide? You know what I think I'm going to do is let's lay out the details of our plan by email correspondence, and then let's talk to each other on our cell phones. And then why not?
ISIS does that, do they?
Why not? Why don't we also post it all on Facebook?
Well, I'm so slow in that area, but even I know better than that.
I'm going to say that's probably a good thing for you, Craig, because nobody believed that you came up with that plan. But I think
Kirk
are going to jail.
we are being facetious, but for a purpose here.
Well, it shows ineptness. It shows they're liars. It shows that they are two-faced.
Yeah, but it also shows that Trump and his gaggle of thousands can't think their way to an intelligent response.
Well, he said he was going to delegate and have all these people that are so brilliant in all their fields that this issue. And where are all those people now? Why are you telling him and nobody else?
Right. There are three absolutely perfect answers. Maybe even more. We brought up more than the three.
But you've done shows that are better.
Yes.
You should go back and review your show so we know what to say.
Oh, my goodness. It's just stunning that we have dumbed down the country to the point where there doesn't seem to be anybody that can think.
Yeah. It's very sad. You know, I have to tell you this. It just came to me. I forgot. All you hear is we're going to make America great again, and we're going to do this, and we're going to, our young people, we're innovators, and we're going to get back to innovation. So I talked to, we have a big Intel group up here. And I talked to one of them is my student, and I asked her, she's from India, and I asked her, how does the world view us as innovators? Are we innovators? Are the young people coming up with stuff? And she just looked at me like, are you kidding? The world views American youth, American students, and world, as he said, they're so busy enjoying their toys, they don't make nothing.
Yeah. You know, I've had some time I've had some time to spend around in the collegiate environment. And what I have found is that the majority, overwhelming preponderance of graduate students, and it doesn't matter if it's in engineering, the hard sciences, medicine, law, But the overwhelming preponderance of graduate students, I don't much care about education. Don't much care about, because I think getting a PhD to teach is an utter waste of time. But in the difficult, what they call STEM, mathematics, sciences, and engineering, mathematics. The overwhelming preponderance in American colleges or foreign students, there is a disproportionate number from China and throughout Asia, China, Korea, Japan, Taiwan. We're allowed to use that name, I guess, Taiwan. There's a disproportionate number from those countries, from India and Pakistan, even from the Muslim countries, And they're learning the sciences and engineering, for example, and the law in American schools, and then going back to their countries.
Yeah. Well, UC Irvine, where I used to live in Orange County, UC Irvine was dominated by Asian students.
Oh, you know, when I used to visit my son when he was getting his master's at UCLA, there in his class in graduate school at UCLA. In aeronautical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
At UCLA, there were like 250, 300 students. You know how many Caucasian Americans there were?
10%?
Two.
Two?
Two. Count them. Two. My son and one other.
Wow. Wow.
you wonder we're in a fix.
God, we don't have, you know, if there was time to save anything, we couldn't save anything.
My youngest son just defended his PhD in medicinal chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority, in fact, the overwhelming majority of students in chemistry, organic, inorganic, medicinal, biochemistry, at a school in the heart of Texas, are foreign students, Asians and Indians, primarily.
Mm-hmm. I believe it.
You just say, no wonder.
Well,
we're in this fix.
I mean, you have a whole group of people that have grown up being told just one half of a sentence. You could be whatever you want to be. The other half of that sentence is if you work for it.
Right, if you work for
you
it.
You can be anything you want to be in America if you work for it.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's not you can be. You have the opportunity.
Opportunity, yes.
Right. You have the opportunity. And it's and yet, even if you make enormous sacrifices, if you have tremendous ability, if you have a great plan, if you execute that plan at a 99.9% correct decision-making level, and if you're willing to outwork everyone, you still have a chance to succeed, but there's also a significant chance you won't succeed and that you'll lose everything in the process. So it's not that you can be anything you want to be. It's that there is the opportunity to achieve most anything that you can imagine, so long as you're willing not only to work for it, but that you have properly prepared, you've been appropriately trained, and you're willing to make the sacrifices. And it's not just working hard.
Well, you're 100% right on that. But there again, as you're working towards your goal, other opportunities will open for you. It's not like I said to myself one day that I'm going to be an audio engineer.
Uh-huh.
I never said that to myself.
Right.
But along the way, I did stuff, and opportunities have opened.
Right.
And that's what.
And by the way, if you hadn't prepared in advance to succeed at what the opportunities you were given, what would those opportunities have been worth to you?
Nothing.
You know, I tell my eldest son is married, so this is advice only for my youngest son who's not married. And I say, you know, if you go out every day, and you ask 10 women out to dinner, you will never dine alone, ever. One of the 10, if you engage in conversation, are interested in who they are, and are a gentleman about the whole thing, every day you will you'll dine with someone interesting. If you are not engaged trying to get to know people, trying to create something, trying to further yourself, trying to help others, if you're not engaged, you're not going to find any opportunity. You know, if I were to sit in this house all day and watch television, the only opportunity I would have would be to grow old, weak, and fat. That would be my opportunity.
Well, you'd have a lot of things that you could buy over off of infomercials and stuff, too.
Oh, there you go.
You got opportunity there.
Yes, and be broke.
And be broke.
Oh, don't worry. If your debt ceiling gets too high, you can just raise it. That's all you got to do.
You're not going to find an opportunity, nor a date, by spending your time on Twitter or Facebook. You know, you've got to engage. But talk to people. Get to know them. You know, it's when you were doing other things that led you to be an audio engineer, Scott, one of the things you did is that given the opportunity, whatever it was that you're doing, you engaged with people. You talked to them. You found common interests. And one thing led to another, and opportunities materialized. We seem to have lost that as a nation.
You know what I see that we've lost a lot is because we don't have any manufacturers to speak of, and there's no, and because the chain stores have become the biggest customers in retail instead of all those thousands of moms and pops. The salesman, if nothing else, if you knew your business, you could take those products in your business and go out there and sell them. And you had a great career. People that did not go necessarily to school, or even if they did, it wasn't their first choice. But if you got into sales because of your expertise, there was tremendous opportunities in sales that don't exist anymore.
That's true. But sales is still one of those jobs that most young people today are not interested in pursuing.
Yeah.
Because it's a wholly performance-based occupation.
Yeah, it's my entire career has been on either commission or if I don't earn it, I don't get it. It's no salary.
Right. Yeah, my first I guess from I was 21 through about 29, maybe 30. 100%, maybe even 31, 32. 100% of my income was commission.
Mm-hmm.
And it was commission on sales that I had had made 4 weeks earlier. And so if you took a vacation, you know, others would get the sales that you wouldn't get.
Yep.
If you weren't effective, somebody else got those commissions. You only earned a commission. There's no base. You only earned a living if you could, in fact, perform.
No guarantee.
No guarantees.
No,
and I just happen to think that it's a marvelous way to live. It's tough. And I don't think there's anyone who has ever sold who has been told yes more than they've been told no. In my first year, I was told no so often, I thought it was my last name.
I'd like to meet that guy. I'd really like to meet that guy. I did sales here for a little while, and you hear no all the time.
Yes.
And then you got to make the call to the next guy
with
the mindset that, hey, this is the one. This is the one.
Right. Shake it off. Go to the next one. Yeah. See if you can learn something from the last one. Go to the next one. But it's something most young people do not want to do. And
They'd have to put their phone down and actually look somebody in the eye and talk to them.
Yeah, speaking of looking people in the eye and talking to them, that's not how Americans want to buy things anymore.
No.
Did you hear that between Office Depot, Macy's department stores, and Sears and Kmart, which are one now, that collectively they announced the closure of 1,000 stores between the three of them?
The average number of people in that store and all the community that lives off of those people that go to the grocery stores, that's devastating.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, it's and of course, it's a bit because the sales went online where nobody has to talk to anybody, where you don't have to engage with anybody. You know, you go to a retail store, you got to be analog. You know, there's going to be somebody that's going to say, can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be someone you're going to ask to help find that item. There's going to be someone that's going to be at the checkout line. And so, you know, you want to go to a retail store, you know.
You didn't touch it.
Yeah, you're analog. You've got to engage with people. But online, no, you don't have to. And so, all those people who are engaged in the real world just lost their jobs. Yeah, it's. You know, a devastating thing, and then they
have nowhere to go, and then the government has to pay for them.
And then what happens to the malls?
They're beholden to the government. Then who are you going to vote against?
Yeah, you look at a mall that has the mom and pops.
That will spiral.
Right,
spiral.
The mom and pop never anchors a mall. Sears, Kmart on the lower end malls, Macy's on an upper end mall. and in a mid-range mall, Office Depot, those are headliners.
Yeah.
When they collectively back out of nearly 1,000 malls.
Where does that leave the mall?
Ooh. The little restaurants, all of this, the smaller stores that are in those malls.
Some of the employees eating there, too, you know.
Well, but it's just that when you see a mall that's got its anchor boarded up, it's a kiss of death.
You don't go. No. And the other people can't get out of their lease.
No, and of course, it's an indication of what's going to happen to America. And it's going to be seen around the world. What it's already seen, it's our youth are so preoccupied. And that's the reason, like, when I say that the preponderance in the case of UCLA and aeronautical engineering, it was 99.9%. But when I say that mostly foreigners, I don't begrudge the foreigners for being there.
No.
I think, no.
If I could,
no, they're working at it. I grew up in a little community called Arcadia. California. I just saw the Arcadia Marching Band and the Rose Parade, which I'll speak to in a moment because it made me sick. There were two Caucasian faces amongst the entire band.
Wow.
What, 200 players from Arcadia High School? And these are Arcadia High School Apaches, mind you, and they're all Asian. Now, how did a community, and this is as rural as rural, I mean, as urban as urban gets in the sense of being in a community of just bedroom homes.
Mm-hmm.
Right there in the, next to Pasadena, mm-hmm. not far from downtown Los Angeles. And it's
around the 2
It's 98% Asian.
Mm-hmm.
How in the world does that happen? And they call Caucasians a minority.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing about it is, as I looked to my youngest son who was sitting there watching this with me, I said, how would you like to compete in the sciences and mathematics at Arcadia High School? Because those kids, they're devoted. They're committed. They work at it.
Let me tell you something. The Asian community in Orange County, I had a private art school, as you know, and we had a lot of students, a lot of classes, and big place. The Asian kids would come in. Here's what would happen. The mother and father would look. That's why I kept them up on the wall. They would look and see, oh, my diplomas.
Right.
And all that sort of stuff. They would examine those things. Nobody ever examined those things.
Right.
They would.
Yeah.
Then they would enroll their kids, and I'd ask them, and I'd talk to the kids, are you interested in art? He says, not really, but my mother believes in a well-rounded education, and it'll help me in school if I take classes here.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, they take everything serious.
Yeah, they've analyzed the whole
thing. Any subject matter, and you know that the average American doesn't think squat about art.
Right.
I mean, you know.
Right.
But they took it because they saw the value in it.
Yes, that it would give them a more well-rounded education.
Art, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, that would somehow benefit them in other ways through life.
That's the way I grew up in Australia. Everything was important to an Australian school system. There was no weight-headed because
right.
math or this, because they expected you to be a well-rounded individual when you came out of high school.
Right.
Heck with college.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I hate about political correctness, because what it does is that everybody has to have a singular attitude, a singular perspective, a singular way of believing. And so that's one of the great faults. And I mentioned the Rose Parade. I do want to mention the Rose Parade
sure.
again.
Okay.
When you think of the Rose Parade, what do you think of?
You mean beside the roses and the football game and the parade?
No, not the Rose Bowl, but just the Rose Parade.
Yeah.
Floats with flowers on them, right? Beautiful floats with flowers on them, and high school marching bands, a few college marching bands about the teams that are going to play in the Rose Bowl,
mm-hmm.
but a couple of college marching bands, and a whole lot of high school marching bands from different places around the country and around the world.
Which is a big deal.
Beautiful floats and some interesting equestrian teams with somebody either with a lasso or somebody with really fancy saddles or dancing horses. That's what you expect.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what I saw.
I saw it. I know exactly what you saw. I saw a lot of it.
It was a exposé to the American military, a tribute to the American military. You had the Air Force band and with little fighter jets following them. You had the mounted cavalry, and then officers with all sorts of spaghetti on their sleeves on the side saluting them. B-2 bomber doing the overflight. You even had floats devoted to the U.S. military. You had bands that were holding up signs saying, "We salute you, we thank you for your service." It was a tribute to America's propensity to invade other countries, break countries, and kill people.
And the plague of death showed up, too. You had the Jesus float.
Oh, my goodness, the religious floats. I mean, second only to the military. You know, back to the baby God and the dead God.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, God on a stick. You know, they even had Jesus sitting right there on one of the floats. I mean,
yeah, son of God and everybody.
Yeah, you know, I think that Jesus must have been multisexual, what do they call it, a metrosexual. I think that's an older term now. In fact, my son was using a dating app, and he was going through the various terms that you can choose for yourself. And, you know, being straight and gay and lesbian, transgender and transvestite and all that sort of thing are just two of, like, 50 terms you can apply to yourself. And there's, like, 20 different ways to say you're bisexual. But, you know, have you ever seen a picture of the Christian Jesus that looks like a stonemason, that looks like a guy that lived before there was showers with hot water, before there was a bathtub and indoor plumbing, back at a time where you got really dirty when you walked, and where the bottom one third of whatever you were wearing was covered with dirt, and where your hands were calloused because you were swinging a hammer at a chisel. You ever seen one that looked real?
No.
They're all pretty, aren't they? He's such a pretty God. You know, between the God on a stick of the of Orthodox Christianity and their crucifix, you know, and holding God on a stick, I mean, even the pagans didn't do that.
No.
And even the pagans, when they, you know, depicted their God, they didn't depict their God as a baby. Or dead.
No,
I mean, when was the last time you saw
somebody, you know, that's really powerful with a sword? And
right, yeah. I mean, says Thor, Zeus. Look at all of the statues that we have seen of gods of Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, Rome, Greece. They're, you know, in the early days, they took really powerful animals and gave them wings. Yeah, they put wings on the back of really handsome men and women. You know, that the gods were had the ability to fly. They were the perfect specimen. They had, you know, qualities you would look up. Now, they were false, as all get out. Don't get me wrong.
No.
But why does Christianity go off at demeaning God to the point that their only depictions of God are baby God and dead God?
Serves some purpose to them.
Oh, my goodness. Baby God and dead God. And, of course, then Roman Catholicism, God on a stick. That would be dead God on a stick, mind you.
Dead God on a stick, yeah.
And I think it's just great. We're going to create a religion, and the symbol of that religion is going to be the most excruciating form of torture ever known to humankind. And that's going to be the symbol of religion.
Wear it around your neck.
Have it tattooed.
Have it tattooed on
you. All right, 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 yeah. Uh-huh.
And
a torture device.
Get a touchdown.
Right. And there's not a single one of these people that can realize, wait a minute, God wasn't born. If God, God is.
Yes.
God cannot be born.
No.
If God,
he created a world to be born,
God
to
is.
And be born. Or
God could not die.
Yeah.
So both baby God and dead God are impossible.
Right.
And you made a religion on it.
Mm-hmm. Now that's some kind of fancy talking if you can pull that off.
No wonder God hates Christianity so much.
And he hates it with a passion.
He does. And for very, very good reason, calls it the plague of death. Do you have anything else you want to cover before we return to Yashaya, Isaiah? Yeah, go ahead.
Questions. I don't know what we can cover, but
okay.
I had people email me from time to time, and there was one little quick question. Most of these you can pop off pretty quick. Brad emailed me, and he was concerned about the exodus from Egypt. And you had referred, I think, in Observation 6 to the year estimating around about 1445. And he was thinking 1468 or 67 because of being a Yobel year. Would not the Exodus have been on a Yobel year?
Oh, probably. Yeah.
I like your idea better because I think that would make total sense.
Right. So. Well, I think Brad is probably right.
Yeah.
Listen, here's the issue. Mm-hmm. If you read David Rohl's It's About Time.
Yeah.
His research identifies the timing that the children of Israel were captives in Goshen and treated as slaves, and has unearthed all of the proof that everything Yahweh says about them, the killing of the young baby boys, the straw laden bricks that they built, that the fact that Ramses, the city of Ramses, was in fact a city there dated to that period of time. And he talks about who the pharaoh was at that time. It's not Ramses the Great. Yahweh never says it's Ramses the Great.
And a lot of places say that.
Right, so, and it talks about how after the fact the Egyptians watched and sometimes participated in the skirmishes between King David and King Shaul before him. And so the timing of it is revealed really through the archaeological proof that he provides. But your toughest thing is to try to date it using the tools that we have available to us. So what you can do is you can say, all right, we know for certain that that Dodd laid the cornerstone for Yahweh's home on Mount Moriah in 968 BCE. We know that Yosha came into Jerusalem 4 days before Pesach in 33 CE on our pagan calendar. That would be year 4000 Yah and year 3000 Yah. And you can go back with reasonable certainty to the time that Abraham was on Mount Moriah with Yahweh, with Yishak, affirming the covenant to 968 BCE. But between 1968 BCE. But between 1968 BCE and 968 BCE, when Dodd laid the cornerstone of Yahweh's house there, we try to use the Torah and prophets alone, just really the Torah, to ascertain exactly the year of the Exodus, very difficult to do.
Yeah.
The likelihood of Brad's reasoning being correct, knowing Yahweh, I would say is it probably in the 99th percentile.
Yeah.
But you know there were other things, like for example, Yahweh said that the children of Israel would be slaves in Egypt for 400 years.
400 years, and that right. Well, we mentioned that in our communication.
Yeah, for 400 years, and you know four is the 40 particularly, but it's a number of years of completion of a period of testing. So it's 400 years. Now they were actually there, I think, 440 years, but there was 40 years that they were there, where they were not slaves.
Mm-hmm.
But from what date?
Yeah.
So it's difficult to know from exactly what date was that. It was sometime during Abraham's life, and it would have been towards the end of Abraham's life. But the statement was made, but it doesn't begin until, because Abraham, although he would go into Egypt, he came back out. So it was, it had to be later on that the timing. So I did not ever find it any way that I could pinpoint the time. So I use 1450 to answer the question. I use 1450 as it was no more recent than 1400 BCE, no further out than 1500 BCE. And so I'm using 1450 as my way of saying it's around that period of time.
Yeah.
And is it likely at 960 or 1467, 1468? Mm-hmm. Is it likely that, and we have to use 67, 68 because, first of all, the Roman calendar starts with year one. It does not have a year zero. So to get, for example, from 968 to 33 CE is actually 1,000 years, not 1,001 years, because there is no year zero, and because year one was established wrongly between 1 and 2 years after the arrival of the sun, not upon the important time, which was the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, and Shavuot, which was year 4,000, and therefore occurred in 33 CE.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the...
Yep, factor all those things in.
Yeah, I think Brad is highly likely to be correct,
yeah.
And is probably correct. I would give it a 99% likelihood, knowing Yahweh. If I can't use logic and reason derived as extrapolated from the Torah to come to a conclusion, I don't. But to his credit, yes, I think he's right. To my shame, somewhere along the way, I should have said that.
Yeah,
I should have said I can't prove it, but my guess is that this is the date.
Yeah, that's pretty good thinking, though. He's thinking along the right lines. I thought I was pretty impressed. You know, so
yeah, I am too. Yeah, good job.
This is not really a question so much as John had sent me some stuff, and he and I'll give you I'll try to send you this link if you like. He did extensive research on Tarshish being.
Okay. Yes.
And they found everything in the recent archaeology. They found everything that absolutely lays it to rest. And then he linked, of course, Paul being from Tarsus. And it just became wow. It
was can you tell me a little bit more about
Tarshish.
Okay, Kirk, can I just want to back up and just give the listeners that weren't listening to that portion of the show a little bit of background. What I had done is that Yeshaya, the second chapter, Yahweh speaks about being against politicians and militaries and the elite of the world, and he says that I'm against the ships of Tarshish and the cargo that that is in them that they desire so much. And so since he is speaking of his return in year 2033, we have to use what was Tarshish, what did it represent, that it would be used as to describe that which he is against in 2033. So going back to 745 BCE during the time the early chapters of Yeshaya are being revealed, what was it in the world, what in the world could be was associated with Tarshish that would be indicative of something today? And so I spent about a day, and I came to the realization that that if you want to look at everything God said about it, you would equate it to the Carthaginians and the empire of the Carthaginians, right, and their monopoly on trade, like America, the fact they were the first real currency in the world, and therefore the reserve currency of the world, like America, and that they built an empire the same way America does. America has the largest empire in the history of the world through its military power, particularly its navy. That's exactly how the Carthaginians did it, and they had a virtual monopoly on the world's economy at the time.
Yeah.
So I came to the conclusion that it was Carthage, and that Carthage equates to America. So John did his research. Did he?
And also a real place and as a metaphor
for Paul.
America.
And
that's a good connection to make. I mean, it's nothing wrong with that. It's just as he researched more and more, and they discovered so much stuff in the hills behind Tarsus as far as where it came, where the Tarsus actually came from originally, the concept. Everything happens to be there that God said would be in Tarsus.
This is now the Tarsus where Paul was born in
This
is the Tarsus in Asia Minor that became central Turkey.
Exactly.
Now,
100 miles up in the mountains, they mined everything, the gold, the this, the that, the tin.
Okay. Now,
they didn't know that. They didn't know the quantities they had until they researched it.
Now,
and
to
then
keep,
when John linked it with, Tarsus being the home of Paul,
right.
And then you see the other nasty side of Tarsus. Besides just the ships, is they also and cargo. One of the cargoes they bring, Americans bring with them, is during Christianity with Paul. I mean, it's just
To keep in mind that when we presented this, one of the things I said is there is an alliteration here that is interesting, in that Tarshish is the this town which Paul came from, and God has more to say negatively about Paul than he does anyone else in human history. Yeah, but that Tarshish can't be the primary metaphor here, Paul, because A, there are no ships. It's inland, and B, you can't sail to it as Jonah did from Jaffa.
Yeah.
You can't sail to the center really of what is present day Turkey. So it can serve as a metaphor, and I think it just because one of the things we've learned throughout our analysis of Yahweh's presentations, his testimony, is that God almost never speaks on one level, and he always encourages us to look at all of the ways what he has said can be edifying.
Yeah.
And so for John to dig, right, for John to say, all right, there are other issues, for example, tin and other ores that were essential for bronze and iron that were found there, the golds and the silvers, to have it be a rich mining place. Because of what is said about it elsewhere in the Torah and the prophets and the writings, and then to say, and it serves as the as a perfect metaphor for, since Yahweh is so against Christianity, for Yahweh to use it to say, right, the place where Paul is going to emerge now, you know, now what is 800 years before he emerges from it, God's going to condemn the place. It's likely that he's correct. I would be fairly certain that it's not the primary metaphor.
No, I just thought boy, that's a connection though. Every time you find those little connections, you know, especially when you translate or something, you say this and then this is this, and you go, wow, that's a wowie.
Yes,
that's the reward for doing it.
Correct.
Doing that type of research is so good.
Yes. And that's what we try to encourage people to do, is that go beyond what we say, what we have learned, what we share, and the more you go beyond it, the richer your experience and your relationship is going to be with Yahweh. And the more you're going to enjoy being part of the covenant family, the more you're going to contribute to the covenant family.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't know how our time's going. I had one other little thing.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, there's a little some conversation going on trying to figure out the nature of Yahweh when he returns in regards to if Yahweh returns and he comes up wretched, he's really more like a Yahusha in the sense that he's a diminished form because Yahweh obviously cannot come into the universe without blowing it up then either, correct?
Well, now here's what I can tell you for certain.
Okay.
And here's where I'm going to where I'm open to discussion.
Okay.
Yahweh has manifest himself in human form many times. six thus far that we know of, where he has taken on human form. He can walk, he can talk, he can eat, he can drink, and he is seen doing all of those things. And that form is Kodesh Kodesh, most set apart to the extreme, which means that you take an energy, spiritual, light-based being, you take that being, you take part of that being, not the entirety of the being, just a little tiny part of that being, and then you diminish that further in the transition from light energy to matter. Right. Okay. So, yeah, he has come in that way, six times. That's not how he's returning. And you know, and everything with Yahweh is 6 + 1 = 7. It's never just 7. Never just 7. It's 6 + 1 = 7. And so the one that is different here amongst these visits is his return.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that's different. Because this return, while he still has to dial himself down, the entirety of God will not fit into a 3.5-dimensional construct.
Right.
Our Earth is a 3.5-dimensional construct. Even if my assumptions, my conclusions, my extrapolations regarding what is wrongly called dark matter and dark energy are correct, and that those are actually dimensions, one of attraction, relationship, one of repulsion, therefore of choice, of being set apart, even if those are correct and the universe is actually six-dimensional, which is what I think it is, the fourth dimension being time and the three dimensions that we're aware of,
right.
Yahweh could not create a six-dimensional universe as a six-dimensional construct.
No, it has to be outside of that.
He has to be seven dimensions to create a six-dimensional universe. A seven-dimensional entity cannot enter in the totality of a seven-dimensional construct cannot enter a six-dimensional universe. It's impossible.
Understood, yeah.
It's of course, right back to Walt Disney and Mickey Mouse.
Right.
Walt Disney can interact with Mickey Mouse through implements, like pen and pencil.
I mean,
yeah, like, exactly.
Go and paint.
But he himself, no part of him even can get into the second dimension, much less all of him. The same thing is true with Yahweh. So Yahweh cannot return to Earth in his entirety. Impossible. So, but he has told us enough to know that he's not coming back in physical, mortal form. He's coming back this time looking like not only the light of a star, but the light of many stars. And so he's coming back as energy. And we are going to be energy-based when we return with him. So he's coming back as energy. The question is, how much of Yahweh is going to be present in Jerusalem on Yom Kippurim in year 3000 Yah, and how much more of Yah will be present 5 days later at Sukkah once he's cleaned the earth of all religious paraphernalia and rubbish? And if that's the question that's being asked,
that led to if he comes in power, does that power that the people who have chosen, mm-hmm. the Yehudim and the Israelites who have chosen to become part of the covenant and recognize who he is,
uh-huh.
they of course are being spared.
Correct.
This light would burn up though those who were not. Does that mean it burns up everybody in the earth? Around the earth?
You know, we
don't have enough information.
Yeah, we've used that as a metaphor, you know, that unless you're covered with the set-apart spirit, being that energetic upon his return would kill you. The only problem I have with that is that Yahweh loves living creatures, loves animals, loves plants. I mean, he really has an affinity.
You know, that would kill all the animals.
Right. He has an affinity for life. And one of the reasons that, you know, one of the dominant reasons for the original flood was to spare life. It will be to spare life when he returns. So I think there'll be another mechanism in play.
Okay.